We appreciate that good singing. It's good to see each one this evening. We're glad that you're here. We talked last evening about the laws of science in terms of scientific proof, and there are some factors that we can prove per the scientific method in science. There are things that are claimed to be proved that aren't, and I hope that became obvious. But how do those things that are proved, that are appropriately called laws in science, relate to these models that we're talking about of creation and evolution? That'll be our approach this evening. And certainly we won't be talking about all of the laws, but we want to concentrate on two of them. But the very fact that there are laws of science is a problem for some people. As they're trying to deny a lawgiver, where did the laws come from? How do we get laws? And we see that difficulty addressed by James Shea, who's editor of the Journal of Geologic Education. He says, this concept of laws originated at a time when the Almighty was thought to have established the laws of nature and to have decreed that nature must obey them. Well, I think that's probably right. The concept of science that we have today was born in the womb of the creation concept. Before that, there was mystical magic, and things happen because of spirits, things you can't really understand. But when we understand they follow laws that can be discovered and understood and repeated, then you can do science. And that came from the concept of the Almighty. Well, he's rejected that, so he has some problems. He says it's a great pity for the philosophy of science that the word law was ever introduced. Can you imagine a scientist saying something like that? I just wonder what kind of scientist he makes if he doesn't believe there are laws. I don't think you can do science without understanding that. Certainly the great scientist did. Men like Albert Einstein says, we're in the position of a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many different languages, including, of course, a great deal of information. The child knows someone must have written those books. We see a universe marvelously arranged and obeying certain laws. And that just seems obvious if you're going to work with science. He goes on to describe two laws in which he has the most confidence. He refers to them as classical thermodynamics. And of course, everybody here understands thermodynamics, right? There are a lot here that do, I assure you. In fact, everyone does. You may not use that terminology, but you're very familiar with the basic ideas. But describing those, he says, the only physical theory of universal content concerning which I'm convinced that within the framework of applicability of basic concepts will never be overthrown. Now, this is just about the only one that he has total and complete confidence in. There are several of them. We're going to look at the first and the second laws of thermodynamics. The first is sometimes called the law of conservation, that says that matter and energy can be interchanged, but neither can be absolutely created or absolutely destroyed. The amount is constant. You can't get something from nothing, is another way to say that. You didn't know that, did you? Yeah, we understand that. But if you're trying to get something from nothing, that's a challenge, isn't it? And, of course, that's the challenge of the evolutionist. Isaac Asimov, one of the more prolific science writers of our time, wrote over 600 science books. Someone said wrote more books than he read, but I don't think so. He says this law is considered the most powerful and most fundamental generalization about the universe that scientists have ever been able to make. That's a pretty strong, flat-footed statement. for a scientist to make. The most powerful and most fundamental generalization about the universe. No one knows why energy is conserved. Maybe he should speak for himself. I think we have some pretty good answers. He says, all that anyone can say is that in over a century and a quarter of careful measurement, scientists have never been able to point to a definite violation of energy conservation. This has been repeated. You have experiments. It's been done in a century and a quarter. This is how you get to be a law, or it gets to be a law. Either in the familiar everyday surroundings about us, in the heavens above, or in the atoms within. That's a very broad application. Never a violation. That's the law that we have confidence in. But the principle of uniformity is supposed to be that principle that allows us to explain naturally the universe that we live in, and it says that everything originated out of nothing as a result of present laws. And this most fundamental generalization about the universe says you can't get something from nothing. And there's an obvious problem here. Isimov understands that and is trying to deal with it when he says, perhaps, this is leaving science, of course, and he was a pretty good science fiction writer. Perhaps in an infinite sea of nothingness. Okay, you got that? You got a sea, but it's nothing. Globs of positive and negative energy. Wait a minute. I thought we were talking about nothingness. You can't do that. Globs of positive and negative energy in equal-sized pairs are constantly forming and after passing through evolutionary changes, combining once more and vanishing. And we're in one of these blobs in the period of time between nothing and nothing and wondering about it. And this is supposed to be science. When he's acknowledged the most fundamental law about the universe says you can't do this, but maybe. And he's dreaming. That's not science. We have the principle of uniformity that tells us that nothing plus nobody equals everything. That's my generalization of that law. And this is what's taught in schools. Seriously. Here's a very popular book. It was high on the bestseller list fairly recently, A Universe from Nothing. I'm not misrepresenting them. That's exactly what they teach. Now, when we have a law that says you can't do that, and a theory that no one has observed that imagines perhaps you can, which one ought to prevail? I think the answer to that is pretty obvious. We want to look particularly at the second law of thermodynamics, which I think is even more devastating to the concept of evolution that says everything is going onward and upward. That second law says it's going the other way. It's the principle of entropy increase. Scientists sometimes like to say things backwards just to make it difficult, I think. Entropy is the measure of disorder, and that disorder is increasing, so it's going downhill toward degeneration. Did you know that's happening around you? We can see all kinds of examples of that. We'll let the atheist, Isimov, explain that for us. He says another way of stating the second law is the universe is constantly getting more disorderly. Viewed that way, we can see the second law all about us. We have to work hard to straighten a room. Left to itself, it becomes a mess again very quickly, very easily. You didn't know that, did you? Even if we never enter it, it becomes dusty and musty. How difficult to maintain our houses, machinery, our own bodies in perfect working order. How easy to let them deteriorate. I don't think there's anybody here that hasn't had experience with that. Even our youngsters see this kind of thing happening. In fact, all we have to do is nothing. And everything deteriorates, collapses, breaks down all by itself. Not what you do, it's just what's happening in the universe. And this is what the second law is all about. Whatever process you're involved in, you're not going to break even. You're going to lose some energy. It'll be dissipated. You can't make an energy transfer without losing some of it. We see that second law of thermodynamics as we buy a new house, and over the years it gets brighter and shinier and or generates. This is what we observe. This is real science. Now, the imaginary process of it going the other way is contrary to the most fundamental generalization about the universe that we can make. But the process of evolution says everything in the universe, including what's here on Earth, is going onward and upward. More complex, more orderly is what's being taught in the schools, contrary to this most fundamental generalization that's established over a century and a quarter, which is, of course, not observed but seen, that is, imagined by the evolutionists, whereas the principle of entropy increase is seen every day and experienced and known by all of us. Now, that's an obvious problem. So how do we deal with that? How do the evolutionists deal with that? Well, they have a standard answer, and you can just be guaranteed, if you're talking to somebody fairly knowledgeable, they're going to give this objection. They're going to say, well, yes, things are going downhill, but we have surplus energy from the sun, and so since we have so much extra energy from the sun, that overpowers this degenerative effect of the second law, and we can have things go uphill. And, yes, we can have things go uphill with extra energy that takes more than that, but you can make water run uphill, can't you, with engineered engine that pumps and make it go uphill. You can see the acorn that grows into the big oak tree, but the information is all there in the acorn, and then eventually it deteriorates and dies. But we do have ways to overpower, at least temporarily, these degenerative effects. Now, the answer to this objection is also obvious when you think about it. Surplus energy is certainly a necessary component of any process that goes uphill, because by itself, it's going to go downhill. But with extra energy, you can make things go uphill, but that's not a sufficient answer. It takes more than extra energy. You get all the parts of this building laid out here on the lot and have the sunshine on it. What's going to happen? Going to have a building after a while? Even if you have all the parts to start with. The sun by itself actually usually deteriorates. Notice the statement by Simpson and Beck of Harvard in their introduction to biology. The simple expenditure of energy is not sufficient to develop and maintain order. A bull in a china shop performs work, but he neither creates nor maintains organization. That makes sense? Lots of energy doesn't mean you're going to have order. The work needed is particular work. It must follow specifications. It requires information on how to proceed. And there's the rub with this objection. Extra energy is necessary, but not sufficient. It takes information. It takes an energy conversion mechanism like photosynthesis and then other processes to put the energy to work, but then you have to have information as well. And information is just staggering when we look at the living world. Carl Sagan, 30 years ago, in the Encyclopedia Britannica, said the information content of a simple cell has been estimated at 10 to the 12th bits. That's 10 with 12 zeros after it. He says it's about 100 million pages. You want to try to read that? 100 million pages of the inside. That's a staggering amount. That's in the simplest cell that we know anything about. And that's what we knew about 30 years ago, and it has literally multiplied since that time. An immense amount. Just staggering, almost incomprehensible. Well, not leave out the almost, incomprehensible amount of information. Science more recently, 2013, says there's about 500,000 DVDs worth of information in each cell, your DNA. 2.2 million, 10 to the 12th, 2.2 million gigabits in would fill 686,000. They rounded it off in the title of the article to it. 500,000 DVDs. Now, how many DVDs is 500,000? If you were to take a stack of 500,000 DVDs, it would form a stack 2 football fields taller than the Empire State Building. Each DVD has got a lot of information, but you got a stack 2 football fields taller than him in each cell. Now, that's just a staggering amount of information. Now, my question is, where did it come from? It didn't come from the sun. Where did it come from? And you just hear an echo of silence when you ask that question on the college campus. There's real irony in the SETI program that's looking for information in the form of maybe little dots and dashes, some kind of ordered sequence that would indicate information from outer space. And we've spent billions with an array of telescopes around the world trying to find some kind of ordered sequence that would indicate intelligence. Information. But you look down the microscope and you see more information than you can comprehend. 100 million pages when you were about 30 years ago. And if you walk along the beach, you see John loves Mary. There's enough information there for you to know this did not happen by itself. But if you've got 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica, how can you ignore the implications? John loves Mary didn't happen naturally, but 2.2 million gigabits? No, there's no intelligence there. There would be intelligence if we saw a few little dots and dashes, but we ignore it when we look down the microscope. Does that make sense to you? That's just incredible blindness, refusal to see. The answer sometimes is, well, we get more information as a result of mutations, which is actually the degrading of the information. As you reproduce, the genes produce more genes, something goes wrong. Or sometimes they're exchanged, you shuffle the cards, but that doesn't produce new cards or new organs or anything novel. And this is a real good question. How do you get this extra information? This was asked when I was testifying before the Texas State School Board, and the answer was mutations. And so the question was, how do you get extra information since mutations degrade and produce less information? How can that work? Well, I was testifying with Dr. Bishop, who was head of the biology department at the time, a number of years ago, and they asked Dr. Bishop, you know, what's a good example of evolution that we're supposed to be able to see if you insist that this is fact and should be in the textbooks? And he said, well, the Texas salamander is a good example of that. It mutated and lost its eyes. And we've learned since then it didn't lose the information. It lost the expression, which then is turned back on when you get them out for several generations in the sunlight. But it appears to have lost its eyes. Did you gain information there, or did you go downhill? This is the best example he could come up with. And so they asked me what I thought about it. I said, well, there's a tremendous amount of information to produce the eye, and it's gone. This is the opposite. And I said, if he came up with a headlight down there, that would be evolution. But he hadn't done that. And they one of the board members said, well, Dr. Bishop, can you come up with a better example than that salamander that went blind? He got mad and left. That was the end of that discussion. Where is a mutation that would increase information? That's a good question. Someone mentioned that, I believe, last night. Would you like to hear what Richard Dawkins would say about that? Maybe the leading spokesman for evolution. I think we have our sound plugged in tonight. Let's see if we can... Now, let me introduce this. This was a question he wasn't expecting, and it's obvious, and one that he wasn't ready to give an answer for, and it stumped him. And so in the process of recording it, he said, wait a minute, turn the cameras off. And so we did. And then he thought up an answer, and so we turned the cameras back on. I say we, a friend of mine who was in England at the time. And then he gave the answer. Now, you have to, as you're listening to his answer, you have to remember what the question is, because you'll get lost. Where is an example of an increase of information in a mutation? Let's hear what he has to say.
Professor Dawkins, can you give an example of a genetic mutation or an evolutionary process which can be seen to increase the information in the genome?
There's a popular misunderstanding of evolution which says that fish turned into reptiles and reptiles turned into mammals, and so somehow we ought to be able to look around the world today and look at our ancestors. We ought to be able to see the intermediates between fish and reptiles, or between reptiles and mammals. We ought to be able to see fish kind of on the way to becoming reptiles. But of course that's not the way it is at all. Fish are modern animals. They're just as modern as we are. They're descended from ancestors, which we're descended from. Way back 300 million years ago, there would have been an ancestor, which was the ancestor of modern fish and the ancestor of modern humans. And that ancestor, if you could have been there then, you could have seen the first steps towards a fish, say, coming out onto the land and becoming... becoming something like an amphibian. But that was a long time ago. You wouldn't expect to see that today.
Did you hear the answer? How you get an increase? No, I don't think he came close. But he knows as much about it as anybody. And why didn't he do a better job? I don't think there's anybody else that could do a better job than he did. And that's it. I asked the question on college campuses around the world, and they immediately say, well, you get extra energy from the sun, but where did the information come from? This is necessary but not sufficient. You've got to explain the immense amount, and they've got no clue, nor can they explain it with mutations. They're at a loss. All right, let's take a break at this point and see if we have some questions, and then we'll do a second session for about 30 minutes and then have another question period after that. Who would have a question? Yes, sir. No, I don't think it's guided. It's just random messing up. Something goes wrong. It's an amazingly dependable, accurate process that very seldom does. But every once in a while, something does. And you get animals maybe with two limbs or limbs missing. The albino is one that's born without the melanin. That's a mutation. Now, that might help him in some instances, but pretty rarely. Usually, the situation may be neutral, can be lethal, but many of the diseases that we have that we spend a lot of money treating involves mutations. cystic fibrosis is one that involves one mutation, and that's not good. It doesn't produce anything new. Now, the theistic evolutionist would say, well, God guides that. Well, but it doesn't produce any new information. It's just not capable of doing that. It selects what's there. And sometimes you get changes so that in the variants, this one is a little better than that one, and so it's... But it explains the survival of the fittest, but not the arrival of the fittest. Where did it come from? No explanatory value there. Yes? I think the second law of thermodynamics is pretty powerful, and that's a law. It says things go downhill. Their objection, we got energy from the sun, helps a little, that's necessary, but it's long ways from being a sufficient answer. There are many others that we'll be looking at through the week. We always want somebody with a simple killer answer so they don't have to work. It takes some effort to learn and prepare for. There's some pretty proficient apologists that sound pretty good until you examine it closely. We need the answers, though. Who else would have a question? Like mutant ninja turtles. Supposed to get bigger and better, but you don't see that. What you see is maybe they got a leg coming out the top of their head or something, lost legs or maybe six legs, and they don't survive nearly as well as the normal form, but you get some things going wrong sometimes. And that's it. And actually, the leading experts, as we'll see, have pretty well given up on the idea. But it's still in the textbooks. That's the way you do it, according to the textbook. And it doesn't work. All right, let's move on quickly to the second session. And if you have more questions, we'll try to deal with them after that. The fossil record, we'll talk more about Friday evening, Lord willing. But they're a good example of what we're talking about right now, it appears to me. In spite of the fact that you're told in your textbook that things were smaller and are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Have you heard that? We see that like propaganda all the time. But as you look at the life of the past, the very opposite is true. The evolutionist believes that man's getting bigger and better and taller. And we can see an increase of about 6 inches in America in the last 100 years. Most biologists would say this is due to nutrition. We've learned something about vitamins. We know better how to feed ourselves. It hasn't taken place all over the world, but in America we see that. If this is an evolutionary change, then you go back 100 years, then you're a full foot shorter, and you go back 1,000 years, and you may be minus a foot or two. And they're talking about hundreds of thousands. So this is not the kind of gradual change that would fit their view, but would obviously fit better nutrition. But this is the concept. Everything is increasing, like the little horses turning into the big horses. We'll talk more about that Friday evening. Big horses and little horses we got running around today, don't we, basically. But when you look at the life of the past, invariably you see a decline in size. As von Engelen and Castor say about one period that we can document in similar quotes from many others, mammalian life was richer in kinds of larger sizes and had a more abundant expression in the Pliocene than in later times. Back then, they were bigger and there were more of them, more varieties. we've lost the variety and they've gotten smaller. That's not what the textbooks tell you, but that's the general rule. And I think we can demonstrate that with a few examples, beginning back from 1961 with one of the heroes of evolution, Louis Leakey. And if you saw Gorillas in the Mist, he was sort of the icon of the evolutionist who's supposed to have really documented the evolution of man, which is simply not true. He did not believe in the evolution of man, which we'll document. But what he did find is very interesting. Here reported in Time magazine, he's scouring the gorge, the Ovoid Gorge there in Africa since 31. Over the years, he's unearthed the bones of an ancient pig as big as a rhino. Y'all have all seen pigs like that. This is the skeleton of one from the Dakota School of Mines. The one on the right is a fossil pig. He continues, a pig as big as a rhino, a 6-foot-tall sheep, a 12-foot-tall bird that didn't look like that. Seen a 12-foot bird? I don't think so. And then the flat-topped skull of a wrecked nutcracker man, which I think was a big ape. And we'll talk more about that Friday evening as well. If the pigs were as big as rhinos, how big were the rhinos? Well, this one was found in India, and it's 20 feet tall, weighed 15 tons from the fossil record. Back to Leakey's article, he's showing here the fossil ram that was found in the Ovoid Gorge compared with a modern ram in the background. You see evolution going on there, or devolution, devolving. And of course, man, we know, is getting taller, we're told, but when you look at the fossil record, you've got abundant evidence that's not the trend. This was a famous fossil found by Leakey's son, Richard Leakey. 5'6", well, that's not really big, except when you study the molars, you can tell his age. He was 9 years old. And we probably have some 9-year-olds here tonight, and they're not 5'6". The average 9-year-old is 4'6" today. And notice the comments made by Richard Leakey. National Geographic was surprisingly large, which is what you got in the textbooks. They were much larger. No. Compared with modern boys his age, he would probably go unnoticed in a crowd. Now, 1, 5, 6 that's 9 years old would probably be noticed. But he says, it contradicts the long-held idea that humans have grown larger over the millennia. Did you know that had been contradicted by the fossil record? When you look throughout the fossil record, you see abundant evidence of it. We excavated this large donkey near Lubbock, Texas, 9 feet tall at the shoulder, known in the literature as Asinius gigantus. I won't make any comments about giant asses from Texas, but that's from out near Lubbock. In the same area, we've got buff bison that were, they had a 12-foot horn span. This was 11 feet tall at the shoulder. Not even remotely close to that, though we've got some pretty big ones, but not like that. Most of us are familiar with the armadillo. The pickup trucks run around and flatten them. But the fossil record shows one 9 times larger. This is a page from a geology textbook. 9 times larger than the present day, here shown to scale. In fact, in the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meeting at Austin in 1999, they announced one the size of an elephant, an armadillo, the size of an elephant. Maybe it looked something like that. I don't know if somebody drew a cartoon of it. But it weighed 4,000 pounds. I don't think we've seen those armadillos around, do we? That might flatten the pickup. Down in Big Bend, we have turtles in the fossil record. The difference is these were 14 feet. The screen looks like about 10 feet, that about the size of that screen. 14-foot turtle from edge to edge of the shell is monstrous. More recently, BBC News 2012 announced they had found Titanoboa, a boa constrictor. See him swallowing the alligator. 50-foot snake, a boa constrictor, could swallow the crocodile over a ton. And here we see the vertebrae of this giant with an 18-foot anaconda vertebrae. 18-foot anaconda is a pretty good size snake, and it looks like it's dwarfed here against the vertebra of the Titanoboa. Now, these are not unusual. This is typical of what you find in the fossil record. We find sharks 50 feet long compared to the 14-foot shark today, looking something like this with a bus for scale, making this photoshopped picture maybe kind of realistic in terms of the fossil record. Camels weren't quite that much larger, but twice as large. This one was found in 2005 in Syria. Now, if you've ever ridden a camel, I don't know how many of you have, but you know those things are pretty tall, and you're bouncing around up there. If you fall off of that thing, you're going to hurt yourself. But they were twice as big in the fossil record. According to the BBC, double the size of a modern-day camel. And then again, more recently, we have this news article, giant species of camel in Canada's height. Here in the Arctic, what are camels getting a little ahead of ourselves, but we had tropical, subtropical fossils around the world. That's not quite like we have it today. You know what that is? You hadn't seen one up close, probably. Fossil fleas, found in 2012. This is the oldest known flea. Well, that ought to be really little bitty, oughtn't it? 10 times the size of modern fleas. And be glad they're gone. But they didn't evolve, did they? As we see over and over and over again. Rats. We've got some pretty big rats around today. This one was found in Venezuela, called the Real Mighty Mouse, buffalo-sized. Science News called him Ratzilla. And then 5 years later, we found one almost twice that big. This weighed over a ton, the largest recorded yet. Maybe my favorite is what Duke University called the Demon Duck of Doom, which you can read about in Wikipedia. 8 feet tall. You ever seen an 8-foot duck? I don't think so. 500 pounds. May have been carnivorous. That's a pretty scary critter, isn't it? It may remind you of a scene from a movie that maybe most of you are familiar with. Wake everybody up.
Fairly alarmed here.
We could relate to that in terms of some movies we've seen. We've seen cattails. These are Texas cattails. They're pretty good size. They're about 10 feet tall. But nothing like what you find in the fossil record, where many of them are well over 100 feet, up to 120 feet tall. I don't think you're going to find anything like that today. But whether you're talking about the plant record or the insects or the mammals, the critters, the fleas, you see that's just all the way through the fossil record. Here in the book Trilobite, Dinosaurs and Man, the well-known fossil book, all Pennsylvania. Pennsylvanian, I don't think, is a time period. I think it's an environment, basically swamps. That's where most of the insects lived. All of them, all of the insects, all of them, were bigger. How many of you have read anything like that in a textbook? They tell you the opposite. I'm sorry, they're just not telling you the truth. They're covering it up. All were larger. This one was 30 inches. Here in Science Daily 2007, there was an article, Why Were Prehistoric Insects Huge? And talks about the documentation. They were once dramatically larger than they are today. We've seen a remarkable, reduction in size over the course of history. That's not what evolution predicts. That's exactly what we would predict. In terms of the curse that was placed on the earth, things are going to degenerate down to dust. Physiological changes took place, and we understand that. That's not what they predict. We look in the past, and maybe the most familiar fossil from the past would be the dinosaurs, and they're much, much bigger today. Or are they? They're gone. Well, what? Is that an uphill process? Sometimes people say, well, you see that animals did live in the past and they went extinct, and that's evolution. That's as downhill as you get. That's like saying the fish that lost its eyes is an example of evolution. Oh, it's going the wrong direction, isn't it? Seismosaurus was about 177 feet. They found two or three of them since Seismosaurus has been dethroned as the biggest that are larger. Here, Dinosaur Jim Jensen is standing beside a bigger leg than this one. This one we dug up in northwest Colorado. It's just over 10 feet when you get up to where he really starts going up from there. That's a giant creature. How many creatures are like that today? And what happened to them? I won't get off on that track. Not sure they're all gone. But we do have at least one representative, unquestionably, of the beakhead family, that is the family of the dinosaurs, that's still alive on Earth today, the Tuatara from down in New Zealand. They advertise him as the only living relative, and he is alive and was a relative of the dinosaurs. He's up to 24 inches, most of them about 8 inches long. Is that uphill or downhill? You get the picture. You just can't study the fossil record without being slapped in the face with the fact they were always bigger. I was helping my professor when I was at Austin Peay State University. He was writing a book on the fossil mammals of Kentucky, and we had found a collection in a cave when we were doing some spelunking, and I brought him some of the fossils. He said, this is Pleistocene. I looked at it, and I said, well, how do you know that? He said, well, they're 20 to 30% bigger. Pleistocene is, of course, the most recent ancient period, and it gets bigger as you go back, it would seem. This is throughout the fossil record, and you've been lied to. I'm sorry. That's just the truth about the matter. And that's obvious when you begin to compare. We've got a database of well over 300 animals compared with what we have today from the fossil record. And in that database, the average is 50% bigger today. Some of them are 9 times bigger. We've shown you the more dramatic examples. But of 400, you've got 50% bigger on the average. That's not just isolated examples. How? Why? I don't know that I can prove the second law of thermodynamics did that, but it sure smells like it. Everything else is going downhill. It looks like that's what's happening here. It was interesting that some of the naturalistic scientists were pressed to explain this downward trend that we see throughout the fossil record, and they came up with a new answer. What's causing this decline? Why are animals going downhill? It's because of global warming. I'm serious. That's why. Here from PhysOrg 2011, global warming is reducing the body size of many animals and plant species. Microorganisms, the top predators, mammals, birds, beetles, bees, spiders, wasps, grew smaller over multiple generations. Well, see, they admit it when they think they've got an explanation, but it's due to climate change, which gets blamed for a lot of things, doesn't it? Got a chuckle out of that. What about the earth that we live on? Do we see things going downhill here, or do we see them going uphill? And I think everywhere we look, especially with the tectonic forces, the forces that shape the earth, as we look at the processes going on here, is this going uphill or downhill? You're eroding the surface of the earth, dumping it in the ocean at a prodigious rate, about 127.5 billion tons every year, dumped in the ocean as a result of the rain and the erosion. It's just going out to the earth. How much is over 100 billion? This is enough to fill a freight train that would reach all the way to the moon and halfway back. That's dumped in the ocean every year. And that's not helping the continents any, is it? How long could they stay? Billions of years? No way. You're talking about somewhere between 10 to 12 million maximum. But they're still here. And some of them pretty good size, so and a lot of mass above the ocean level. Well, there's some serious problems there. And where you really see it dramatically is when you look at the heavens. However, it just astounds me that when you listen to the astronomer, invariably he's talking about stellar evolution and galactic evolution and how everything is going uphill and getting more organized and forming galaxies. And he doesn't see any of that. What he does see is the opposite of that, but he believes the opposite of what he sees. Now, if that sounds like a brash statement, let's just look at some of the evidence. You go out to the night sky, a good observer can observe about 100 of these meteorites, shooting stars, we call, virtually every night. Now, sometimes you have the meteor showers that are very dramatic, and you see hundreds of them in just hours. This was the Linoid meteor shower. Several years ago, this is one that was approaching the sun and looked like this, came out the other side of the sun looking like this, which didn't help it a whole lot. But what are we watching here? Something has come apart and comes into the atmosphere and burns up. Or if it's not completely apart, it'll be apart as it gets near the sun or something like this. They're coming apart everywhere you look. And they're little bitty pieces of pieces that are eventually burning themselves up. We look at the moon and we see it's been pockmarked by all of these pieces that have bashed themselves out of existence into the surface of it. There are nearly 5,000 craters, or just over 5,000, that have been documented on the moon. Mercury, all of the bodies that we can see carefully are looking like this, almost all of them. Some of them are more gaseous that don't form craters. As you look up in the sky, one of the more dramatic observations involved the comets. And how we got those is a real interesting question. But tonight we're looking at what happens to them. They come apart. And here is the comet Hale-Bopp that just split in pieces. Notice the comment by Fred Quipple of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory. Comets tend to split in pieces. They don't tend to come together and form. They tend to split, particularly when they're near the sun or Jupiter, or even also where they're quite undisturbed in space. Some comets seem to tire out and die. And isn't that a surprise, according to the second law? The most dramatic thing we see in the sky involves the sun. And, wow, this is very energetic. But what's happening here? We're dissipating, we're told, about 4.5 million tons per second as a result of the thermonuclear radiation, the process that's going on that produces the heat and the light. And as we look at it through various lenses, we can see very dramatic things going on. It's, quote, burning up, and rather dramatically, at 4.5 million tons per minute. And then you've got the solar flares and the solar prominences that blast immense amounts of material into space. We can get an idea of how much is involved when we compare the approximate size of the Earth with these flares. Just, wow. It's not helping the sun any when it loses that kind of material. In addition, you've got the solar wind that's blasting out maybe another million tons per minute. And so you've got a total, just roughly, of at least 5.5 million tons per minute that's being dissipated out into space. What's going on here? Is this helping the sun? This is dramatic deterioration. Now, the sun is just an average star, very special in some ways, but in terms of size and how much dissipation of energy, fairly average. And you just, you multiply what you see going on here by what you see in the universe times billions, and you see what's happening in the universe. And it's not uphill. It's dramatic deterioration. Now, there's a lot of mass in the sun. It's going to take a while for it to dissipate, but that's exactly where it's headed, and very obviously so. Sometimes it gets even more dramatic when you see stars that blow themselves up. The planetary nebula will blast about 20 to 30% of their mass, boom, into outer space just around them in beautiful form. Why do they blow up? Well, we're not sure. There's some theories. But it's not helping the star any, is it, as it does that? A planetary nebula, this one, the Helix, and then it's from a dying star, as it says. And here's one that, does that look like it's coming together, or it's blowing up? That's what's happening wherever you look in the universe. Some of them rather orderly, following the laws of physics that are demonstrated in the explosion. Here, the Spirograph Nebula blew up. NASA says this is ultraviolet radiation that floods out in the surround. Sometimes you'll hear, okay, it's glowing. That means it's the pressure coming together, which is not the case at all. It's like these fluorescent lights. What happens? You've got gas. You send the charge through it, it excites the particles, and it emits light. It fluoresces. Well, these planetary nebulas fluoresce when the explosion excites the gas and produces the illumination. Radiation floods out into the surrounding gas, causing it to fluoresce. And over the next several thousand years, the nebula will gradually disperse into space and will cool and fade away. This is what's happening everywhere we look. But if you think that's dramatic, that's nothing until you get to the supernovas, the novas that just blast themselves totally out of existence. Boom! And the star's gone with an expenditure of energy that's just almost unimaginable. And they leave remnants in space where we can see that happen. Here's Kepler's supernova remnant. It's described as, well, here by NASA, what caused this mess? Some type of star exploded. Astronomers continue to explore the expanding debris around the cloud. It's just a mess that's expanding from the explosion. This is the beautiful Crab Nebula. This is the mess, NASA says, that's left when a star explodes. Does that sound uphill or downhill to you? Is that hard to figure out? You have to ask that over, because people really don't want to think that way. But it's just so obvious. This was actually observed in 1054 A.D. by the Chinese and the Arabs and the Native Americans, who recorded it several different places in their petroglyphs. Dramatic explosion in the sky. Happened in July of 1054. May have been on the 4th of July, we don't know. But that's what it looks like. Supernova remnant W49B is just beautiful, but it's this debris, a blinding flash in which the concentrated power equals that of 10 quadrillion. You got that? 10 quadrillion suns. Now, the sun, you got 5.5 million tons per minute times 10 quadrillion being dissipated. This is not uphill. This is dramatic, prodigious deterioration. How do you miss that? This is what's going on everywhere you look, and just, sometimes just absurdly, dramatically. But how do they get together? Well, gravity pulls them together. You turn loose gas in this auditorium, and it's going to come together and wad up like a ball, isn't it? Does that happen? You see the smoke from the campfire coming up, and you see it all collect in little balls? Or does it spread out? There's gas pressures that you learned about in physics. They're expansive forces that you can measure that are 60 times greater than the attractive forces caused by gravity. Now, you've got two forces opposing each other. One's 60 times greater than the other. Which one's going to prevail? Is that a hard question? Yeah, there's gravity, but it's trying to overcome these expansive forces of the gases. And so we have never seen the formation of a star. I think that's a dramatic realization. Here from Science Magazine, we have yet to directly observe the process of stellar formation, but all of the earth science textbooks will tell you just exactly how it happened. The gas caused it to come together. Second law of thermodynamics says it goes the other way, but they're dreaming. Here, Janssen, writing from the School of Earth and Space Exploration, Arizona State University, says no computer program has yet been fully successful in creating a virtual star from realistic initial conditions. They can't even make it work virtually on the computer. They can't make it work on paper. And they haven't observed it, but there they are. Well, how do you explain that? Well, you've got to do it somehow, and they do it in spite of the evidence. We should be able to observe something like this. You just do some quick calculations. You've got something like 100 billion galaxies and maybe 200 billion stars each, we're told. You got that? That's just too big to fit in a brain, isn't it? Well, you spread this out over a long time. The universe is billions of years old. Well, let's say it's 20 billion years old. And you take the number of stars that we have, spread it out over 20 billion years, the formation rate would be over 30,000 per second. If it's 20 billion years, they say it's about 13.4. We're being generous at 20. If they form at the rate of 30,000 per second, you ought to see something somewhere, shouldn't you? Never seen one. And we have dozens of documentations of that in the handout. J.C. Brapp, writing in Sun and Stars, one of our more famous astronomers, says, contemporary opinion on star opinion holds that the objects called protostars are formed as condensations from interstellar gas, and that's in your textbooks. This condensation process is very difficult theoretically, and as we've seen, they can't even come up with a virtual rendition of it on the computers. No essential theoretical understanding can be claimed. Can't make it work on paper. In fact, some theoretical, and the truth is it's more than theoretical, but the evidence argues strongly against the possibility of star formation. The most fundamental generalization about the universe is it doesn't organize, it disorganizes. And we know that the expansive forces are 60 times greater than the attractive. Yeah, that's very difficult theoretically. I almost feel sorry for him. Here's an atheist who's trying to explain this, and it's a problem. In fact, Godfrey Bainbridge, director of the Kitt Peak National Observatory, says if stars did not exist, it would be easy to prove this is what we expect. You make predictions, and you test the model, and you see if the predictions fit your model. Well, what he's saying is, it doesn't fit our model. It's not what we predict. Now, all of the quotations that we have used are from the atheist. They're not going to overemphasize their problems. We'll talk more about that process later. I'm going to break that rule and make sure you understand. This is a creationist I'm quoting from. Dr. George Mulfinger had his PhD from Syracuse University in astronomy. And he says there are really only three things wrong with our present view of stellar formation. First, it's unscriptural, he says. What is there about Scripture that would contradict? Genesis 2:1, he says, thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them continue to be made all the time. That's not what it says, is it? It was finished. Done. God spoke, as David put it, and it was done. That's objection number one. Number two, it's never been observed, and that's what science is all about. And number three, it's theoretically impossible. But he said, aside from those three problems, it's a real winner. I think he summed it up well. Multiply the problem of star formation by hundreds of billions, and you got the problem of the galaxies, which are assemblages of stars. Stars that have organized themselves, they say. They can't explain the organization of the star. Now they want to try to explain the assemblage of stars. Here, Frink, writing in Science, says, we're starting from a shaky foundation. We don't understand how a single star forms, yet we want to understand how 10 billion stars form. Now, they don't have a clue. But we're learning more. And here, from the extreme deep field probe into space, we're told we can see all the way back to just almost to the Big Bang. Hubble telescope reveals farthest view into the universe ever. Light traveling at the assumed speed would be seen way back, right from the Big Bang, as they assume. We're seeing better, and the problems are getting worse. They predicted they'd solve the problems. The opposite has happened. Here from space.com, the photo reveals the wide range of galaxies. This is that deep field view. Supposed to be just a few hundred thousand years in the 13.4 billion years since the Big Bang. A wide range of galaxies, not baby galaxies, from spirals that are Milky Way lookalikes to hazy reddish blobs. The photo reveals a wide variety, all kinds, just like we see everywhere else, but we should be seeing the baby galaxies, as revealed here from Gemini Observatory. This is a diagram from their publication that shows the Big Bang that you see over here on the left, and the little baby stars coming into existence, and then the baby galaxies coming together and getting more and more mature into the spiral galaxies that like we see today. That's the theory, but that's not what they observe in this deepest view ever. What they see is mature galaxies right from the start. Just the opposite of what's predicted. In their publication, there's a glaring question, they say. Why do galaxies in the young universe appear so mature? That's the opposite of what the model predicts. Here, Cohen, writing in his journal, and actually that's in Science, University of California, Davis, Science News, galaxy formation theory is in peril. Over the past 18 months, several teams have found so many massive galaxies from the early epoch that the theory is being stretched to the breaking point, several astronomers say. This is just ripping it. That's not what you're expecting to find. Let me illustrate this way, and I can demonstrate I'm not overstating the case. You look way back to the beginning, you ought to see the baby stars, the baby galaxies. You're looking into the stellar nursery, as some of them call it, and expecting to see babies, and instead you see grandpa. That's a problem. Now, if you think I'm overstating that, about 2 years after I began using this illustration, which I concocted, this appeared in Astronomy, 2005. Galaxy formation theory is in peril. Here's Grandpa in the nursery with the babies. Maybe somebody saw my lecture and drew a picture for Astronomy. That is exactly the problem, and a fair representation of it, and they are actually doing that themselves. James Treffel, who is professor at George Mason University, says there shouldn't be galaxies out there at all. Well, Yeah, there shouldn't be stars. You can't make it work theoretically. Well, how do you get the collections of stars? And even if there are galaxies, here's star one problem. Problem two is the galaxies, the assembly of stars. But then here's number three. The galaxies shouldn't be grouped together, but you have the clusters of galaxies, which just multiplies the third time the problem. The problem of explaining the existence of galaxies has proved to be one of the thorniest in cosmology. By all rights, they shouldn't be there, yet there they sit. And we're told the astronomers can explain all of this. Well, you just look at them try, and many of them are honest enough to just say, we can't do this. We expect it to go downhill. They expect it to go uphill. One of us is doing pretty well. We look at the universe, our closest neighbors, and you read the Earth Science textbook, and it just all condensed out of the nebula, the planetary nebula theory. The gas was circulating, and it just condensed into the solar system. Lots of problems with that. We could spend the evening discussing it, but just basically, fundamentally, the sun has 99% of the mass of the entire solar system. But the planets are the ones doing all the moving. 99% of the angular momentum is with the planets. Now, here's the Earth just sort of slowly rotating around lazily, and the planets are just the ones zipping around. But they all condensed out of the same galaxy, the same nebulous. How do you get the celestial mechanics that'll make this go slow where 99% of the mass is and separate from the mass the angular momentum? If you know anything about celestial mechanics, you know that just can't be. In fact, here, Ross Taylor, writing from Cambridge University, says the ultimate origin of the solar system's angular momentum remains obscure. We don't have a clue how these planets got to spinning with the Earth not. We've learned a lot from the moon, and a tremendous amount of information that is unexplainable in terms of natural origins. Lissiter says, in all developing a theory of lunar origins that would make sense of the data proved very difficult. Writing in Nature, the best explanation was observational error. The moon did not exist. It just won't work in terms of their concepts of origins. The way you test a model is you make predictions and then you see if it fits. And they're saying if stars didn't exist, that's what we'd expect, that there shouldn't be galaxies, the galaxies shouldn't be grouped, the solar system can't exist, the best explanation of the moon, it does. What is it that they can explain? They make predictions and they fail over and over, but they still have great faith in this onward, upward, in spite of what they're seeing. The scientific question is, which of the two models explains the data best? One of them predicts degeneration, the other predicts the opposite. Increase in information and order, and what do we see when we look at the world we live in? What do we see when we look at the life of the past? Uphill or downhill? When we look at the universe around us, what do we see? This is what science is about, our observations. Now, I think it's very obvious which model is served best by the evidence. And there's some other clear implications we'll conclude with this evening. Isaac Asimov, again, the atheist, is challenged with the implications of what we've been talking about. It says, as far as we know, all changes are in the direction of increasing entropy, of increasing disorder, or increasing randomness, of running down. Yet, the universe was once in a position from which it could run down, he says, for trillions of years. Well, if it's all going down, it got up somehow. How did it do that? Because all the natural processes are opposite, going the other direction. How did it do this? How did it get into this position so it could run down? Lipscomb is an atheist. He's writing in Physics Bulletin very honestly. Commendably. He says, I think, however, we should go further than this and admit the only accepted explanation is creation. I mean, something had to do this that's not Natural laws say the opposite. It goes down. But you got to get supernatural in order to get up here, because natural doesn't do that. I know that is anathema to physicists, as it is to me, but we must not reject the theory we do not like because the experimental evidence supports it. Now, this is not the first chapter of Genesis. This is the experimental evidence that slaps the atheist in the face so that he says that's the only reasonable explanation for what we're looking at. And two very knowledgeable scientists have acknowledged the implications, and these would have to be classified as creationists. They wrote the book on thermodynamics that's used in virtually all, last time I checked, in every one of the Texas universities and around the world. I had a professor when I was lecturing in San Antonio stand up and said, "That's the book I teach. What are you going to say about that?" I said, "Well, let's just listen to what they had to say." We see, and this was in the foreword to the book he taught, we see the second law of thermodynamics as a description of the prior and continuing work of a creator who also holds the answer to our future destiny and that of the universe. It's going downhill and it's going to end. The creator had to start it, and he's going to be there when it ends. And that's the clear implications of laws, and the laws themselves say somebody produced those laws. Those laws you're going to face in the day of judgment. We have physical laws, we have spiritual laws. This is what David's talking about in Psalm 19. The heavens are telling the glory of God. Their expanse is declaring the work of His hand. And then he goes on in verse 7 and says, the law of God, and he's talking here about the spiritual law, is perfect, restoring the soul. You're not going to break God's law. You may think you break His laws, you don't. You just break yourself against them. They stand, and they'll face you in the judgment. If you're here this evening and haven't rendered obedience to the gospel of Christ, we want to extend His invitation and encourage you to come confessing your faith, repenting of your sins and being baptized into Christ. You've done that. Your faith has waned. You've wandered away. We plead with you to come back and be restored through confession and prayer while we stand together and sing.